Hi, Cameron Wilson joining you for Bush Telegraph on RN and Radio Australia. The program is dedicated to conservation today. We know Australia's got a shocking record for killing off our native animals, so today we're looking at what's changing, what we're doing differently to try to turn the tide on 200 years of extinction, and we're looking at shifting community attitudes towards wildlife. We'll also look at international examples of managing conflict between Cape Town residents and baboons.
Humans are no match for the 4x4 baboon, who can go absolutely anywhere. So they would get into houses, into farming areas. The great vineyards of Cape Town are rich pickings for baboons. There's nothing that they can't get into.
We'll have more on the Cape Town residents versus the baboon later in the program. So we know species extinction is a huge problem in Australia, with feral cats, rats, land clearing and population growth all amongst the contributing factors that are just making this such a serious problem in Australia. Even places you might think are protected by their remoteness are under siege. On Christmas Island, feral cats have wreaked havoc on native animals, but the locals have had enough. The locals and rangers are fighting back now, and in 5 years' time, they hope to have completely eradicated cats from the island. Dion Maple is the Invasive Species Project Officer on Christmas Island. Welcome to the program, Dion.
Thanks for having me, Cameron.
How serious is the cat problem on the island?
It's quite serious. Cats have been on Christmas Island for over 100 years since the island was first settled. They're widespread across the entire landmass. There's 135 square kilometres on Christmas Island. We don't have exact population numbers for the cats because the island's quite rugged terrain with thick vegetation, so it's hard to monitor for them, but just based on the number that we see on the roadsides consistently, there's quite a few. There's probably in the order of hundreds of feral cats out in the island within the national park and other Commonwealth areas. But on the island, we also have a number of domestic cats that are microchipped and desexed for community members to have as pets. And there's also stray cats that sort of hang around the township as well.
Okay. So you can't be certain of the cat numbers, but have you assessed the damage they're doing, the wildlife damage?
Yes, there's been many studies on the, you know, what the feral cats eat, and they consistently come up with that they're eating native reptiles, bird life, flying foxes, and also insects and that type of thing. So they're definitely a contributing factor to the decline in species that we've had on the island over the last few decades. But cats are part of the story, but the island, we do have a lot of other invasive species that are causing sort of species decline.
Okay. How serious is that problem of species decline? For many Australians, they might picture Christmas Island as quite a pristine place.
Well, yes, it is. However, islands typically have high rates of endemism, so the species that are found here are found nowhere else on Earth, a lot of them. And along with that, and their remoteness having evolved here for millions of years, is that they're also somewhat naive. And so when a predator such as a cat arrives that they've not been exposed to, the results are quite poor. So on the island at present, I think we've got currently sort of 19 listed species under the EPBC Act, and that includes some that are kind of missing in action and some that we now presume to have gone extinct. And feral cats have definitely played a role in all of those declines.
At what point does a species go from missing in action to extinct? Is there a formal time period?
Yes, I believe it's 50 years under the IUCN guidelines to call something extinct. But a lot of our work here is focused on monitoring these species that are under threat. And so we dedicate huge amounts of time and resources to going out into the forest, looking for these animals. And a lot of them are quite cryptic, so it's very difficult. But we've got a fairly good feel about whether they're still around or not. And just in the last few years, we've had to take a number of species into captive breeding because they were at the point in the wild where they were about to go extinct. So we currently have two species of reptile in captive breeding, the Lister's gecko and blue-tailed skink, that are doing quite well. But we fear that they're now extinct in the wild.
And you lost Gump earlier this year, I think, which was the last species of her type?
Yes, the forest gink.
Yeah.
Whose name was Gump. Yes, he died of old age, unfortunately, in captivity. We were unable to catch any more of that species, which was actually quite an ancient species. And it's quite a sad event for us here, but we feared that it was inevitable because we hadn't seen any others since sort of 2010 in the wild. Mm. And we just had Gump there in captivity.
Even though you knew it was coming, it must be sad, though, to see the last of an ancient species die off, the last individual.
Yes, it is. As conservationists, it's really devastating for us, but we try to focus on the positives of, you know, we have retained two species, one of which had been missing for over 20 years, the Lister's gecko, and we just happened to rediscover it whilst we were collecting blue-tailed skinks, which was a great outcome. So we kind of, you know, we looked to the positives as well.
Yeah.
And I'd say that, you know, the impetus to eradicate cats on the island is sort of being driven by these losses. So it's in a holistic sort of way, as a conservationist, we've got to look to the fact that we're taking some hits, but now we're going to hit back against the cats. We've got some funding coming online as a environmental offset from the local mine, which is great, and there's involvement from all levels of government. We work closely with the Western Australian Department of Parks and Wildlife with cat eradication work and other community groups and all levels of government. And to date, even though we're heading for a full-on eradication attempt, there's actually been a program running for about 5 years, and there's been over 500, possibly 600 cats removed from the township already.
But there's so many parts of Australia where the idea of wiping cats out, it might be a dream, but it's not likely to happen. Why do you think you can be successful on Christmas Island?
Well, just because it's an island and there's a finite amount of land is a huge benefit to attempting eradications. And this is, you know, a trend worldwide that you target islands because they're refuges for species, and the results speak for themselves once you eradicate cats from islands. And in fact, on Christmas Island, where we've basically removed all the stray and feral cats from the township, we've had a nesting area of red-tailed tropic birds bounce back from where a few years ago there was like 100% mortality of fledgling chicks from cat predation, to like over 90% success rate. So eradicating cats on islands, it can be done, and because you've only got a limited amount of land, you can sort of know that once it's done, there's going to be no more cats coming into the area.
Mm-hmm.
I guess on the mainland, it's a bit trickier because it's just like these huge, vast areas where we've just got a smaller area to deal with.
You're hearing here from Dion Maple, who's the Invasive Species Project Officer on Christmas Island. Our program today on Bush Telegraph is totally dedicated to conservation efforts and how they're changing. Also with me is John Wynarski. Now, John is Professor of Conservation Biology at Charles Darwin University. John, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
No worries. I'm actually speaking from Ellis at the moment, so it's far away from islands as you can be in Australia.
Yeah, long way from islands. But I am interested in that point that Dion raised there about their importance in the overall conservation effort here in Australia. Just what role do islands play?
Yeah, they're crucial for two reasons. One, for oceanic islands like Christmas Island. There's been a whole lot of evolution and speciation on those islands. So many of them have endemic species that occur nowhere else. And Christmas Island, Norfolk Island, Lord Howe Island, they're probably the best that there are in Australia in that context. But the other one is that many of the continental islands that were formerly joined to the mainland, have retained populations of species that have disappeared from the mainland. So things like a whole range of marsupial species that formerly occurred extensively across mainland Australia also happened to occur on a couple of islands, and simply because of that good luck, the fact that they became extinct on the mainland, they retained populations on these islands, so we haven't lost them entirely. So islands serve both as a really important refuge for much of Australian fauna.
Okay, so we've heard the Christmas Island example where it's about eradicating a predator, but are we also seeing other examples where, say, a species is shifted to an island because it offers a safe haven?
Oh, absolutely. It's island translocation, as they're called, so that if we can't resolve on the mainland a predator or other invasive species issue, there are many islands which function as refuges, and we can move some mammal species or some bird, plant, whatever species, from their impossible situations on the mainland to islands where those threats aren't currently operating. Mm. And there's many good examples of that, and it's been a really vital part of the Australian conservation effort.
It's been done, I think, in New Zealand for some time as well. Have they had considerable success?
Oh, yeah, I think New Zealand leads the world in that, and we follow fairly close behind now, so it's, you know, it's a remarkable opportunity. It's not the best in the world outcome. I mean, ideally, we'd like to get rid of these threats from operating across the mainland areas as well.
Mm. So in some ways, is it when it's your only option, when you just think you're facing a losing battle on the mainland?
Yeah, it's a, sort of a, I guess, a short-term security operation that we can't resolve the mainland situation, but at least we can keep these species alive by putting them somewhere which is safe.
Yeah, but are you keeping them alive with the view of maybe one day reintroducing them to whether it is just the wildlife or large fenced off areas on the mainland, or is it just to say, look, we've saved the species?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not a long-term objective. The long-term objective is to actually bring them back, either to sheltered areas where they're fenced from predators, or in the long run, over decades, we should be able to resolve some of these problems. Over decades, we should be able to control feral cats on the mainland. Mm.
The very fact we're doing this now, what does it say to you about the changing attitudes or the value that Australians now put on our biodiversity and our fauna in particular? Because this comes at cost, and it's not something that the gains are not something most people will see. They're not living on the population aren't living on Christmas Island, for example. So do you look at the fact that these programs are now taking place and think that it's a statement, or it says something about the attitudes of Australians now?
I think gradually the attitudes are changing, and that people are appreciating that what we have in Australia is really important in terms of our natural heritage, and that we should be contributing to maintaining that heritage and willing to invest. And I guess we're also influenced, I suppose, by some of the successes, for example, by marine species on islands where they're safe. And examples such as Macquarie Island, where a whole range of pests were eliminated. So conservation science isn't necessarily entirely dismal. There are good outcomes if you do it the right way. And those good outcomes are really important in getting the community on side and prepared to invest.
But you must, getting funding for this must be a challenge, and surely just the economics alone mean you can't save every species that's under threat through this method.
Oh, it's not the panacea for all problems, certainly no. But for Christmas Island, we know that cats are affecting the survival probability of a whole range of species which occur nowhere else. So it's really, you get a really good benefit from the cost that you're putting in.
And is that a key criteria for when you decide where to target, just the fact that maybe these species don't exist elsewhere?
Oh, look, no activity of government should be done randomly. You know, you should be making these investments based on rational considerations, and conservation's the same as anything else. You can rationalise it and figure out where you can get the greatest benefit for your investment. So, yeah, that's certainly the case. Can I just bring in another reverse example to the one which you've been talking about with Dion? And that is that there are cases still in Australia where many islands have still got important conservation values, but those values are now being affected by the movement of pests or weeds to those islands. So there's biosecurity problems as well in Australia. Mm. For example, I was working in the Northern Territory, a couple of islands, and the Gulf of Carpentaria, the Pelew Islands, which are really important refuge areas for a whole range of mammal species that had disappeared from the mainland. And what happened there was one family went to the islands to establish an outstation, brought two cats, and those two cats have now caused the extinction on those islands of about three mammal species. So we've got to be...
One family is... You can pretty much trace back their actions to the extinction.
It's like a cut... an open shut case, that one. And, you know, that's perfectly understandable. People like cats as pets, and they move them here and there, and when they move to islands, they may well take cats with them. So we've just got to be more aware of the values and the biosecurity problems on many of our islands and try to increase the security and understanding, I think.
Dion, is there any question, or has there been much discussion on Christmas Island of the consequence of removing the cats? I guess initially it sounds like a good thing, but perhaps they're playing a role in, say, suppressing rat populations or other pests on the island.
Yes, it's certainly something we consider, and in our current lead-up role, we're examining the changes that might occur in the forest post cat removal. But what we're going to do is also have a lot of, we'll have a steering committee with the right experts and partners to sort of walk us through what might occur if there is a release of, say, the rat population, what measures we can take to reduce the amount of damage that may occur. But also we've got a PhD working on the modelling of the predator-prey relationships on the island so that we can sort of, in a way, predict what might occur. But having said that, it's early days in the eradication, and before we do go island-wide with a baiting effort or such, we will be examining those issues further.
How do you say bait for cats and make sure you don't bait for native animals at the same time, have these flow-on effects you don't want?
Well, with a lot of good planning and a thoughtful campaign, what we'll do here is we'll have an integrated process where we do trapping of cats, shooting and baiting. And baiting will occur sort of in two different ways, potentially, or three actually. We might bait alongside the roads with little gantries that string the bait sausages up off the ground so that they're not accessible to land crabs in particular, or other animals on the island. So it's really targeted to being accessible only to the cats. And in addition, we'll probably do something similar in the forest on foot, where we string up the sausages. But we're also looking at the potential for doing an aerial baiting campaign with baits as well. So if we go down that road, what we'll do is we'll bait in the middle of the dry season, sort of at this time of year currently, where there's not a lot of activity in the forest, especially for land crabs. They're all sort of underground, molting and in their burrows because it's so hot. So we sort of do a targeted campaign to reduce the exposure of non-target animals to the baits. But importantly, with sort of baiting cats, the the only other native mammal still extant on the island, which is now critically endangered, is the Christmas Island flying fox. So they're not feeding in the same sort of realm of the forest, and it's been that they, you know, they eat fruits and leaves and such and nectar. The exposure won't be to the other mammal that we're worried about.
So you can be strategic about all this. John, just the last one for you.
Yeah, sure.
Is there anything that you've just essentially reluctantly given up on? Any species that you just think are too far gone?
I think all problems are resolvable, and that with sufficient goodwill and community interest, we should be able to save all species. You know, if the government's not willing to fund it, then there's a whole non-governmental sector that should be able to invest. So no, we should not give up on anything.
Might leave you to it there, John. I know you're in Alice. It sounds like the wind's blowing a little there today. So thanks for stepping out at the conference. Appreciate it. All the best.
No, thanks. Bye. See you
then. John Winoski. You're hearing from there, Professor of Conservation Biology at Charles Darwin University. And Dion, thank you to you as well. Dion Maple is the Invasive Species Project Officer on Christmas Island. You're listening to Bush Telegraph, the entire program today dedicated to conservation efforts in Australia and the innovative approaches that are taking place around the country. But also, we'll take something of a stock take, if you like. We'll look back at some of John Gould's predictions for extinction in Australia. Now, John Gould, of course, associated with ornithology and the bird books, but also documented mammals, Australian mammals, on the East Coast comprehensively in the mid-19th century. So we'll take a look at what he predicted at the time and how much of that has come to fruition. But first, let's look overseas and the conflict between humans and native animals and how it's being managed in South Africa. Professor Justin O'Rean is a behavioural ecologist at the University of Cape Town, and he argues that we're in the midst of what he calls wildlife wars, a conflict where there are no winners. He's in Australia for a series of talks, and he's deplored our attitude and practices such as shark baiting and croc culling. He's been calling for a much more sensible approach. Professor O'Rean, welcome to Bush Telegraph.
Thank you.
Can we start with a definition of wildlife wars?
Yeah, it's not an official biological term. The field it's part of is human wildlife conflict, and essentially it's the conflict between humans and wildlife over resources. So be that land or be that food. And what we're seeing is throughout much of southern Africa, these conflicts are escalating. They range from lions eating humans through to white sharks eating humans. So apex predators on land and apex predators in the ocean. And, you know, a lot of the research we've been doing as well is once you remove those top predators from systems, how things get out of kilter. So baboons in Cape Town. Nothing eats them anymore, and as a result, they've become something of a pest. And these are great challenges for biologists because we have to not only find out what the drivers of the conflict are, but try and come up with solutions.
So you tend to refer to the conflict between humans and animals that are native to that natural environment?
Yes, I know in Australia you have extraordinary problems with introduced species, and it definitely pertains to that too. So we have, I think the greatest similarity is probably the wild pig. We have similar levels of conflict. So it's not only native, it can be introduced species too.
So tell me more about the situation with baboons in and around Cape Town. The nature of the conflict that was taking place, how problematic was it?
It was extraordinary, actually. Going back sort of 10 years ago, levels of conflict were absolutely out of control. Property prices were being adversely affected. Quality of life was seriously compromised by the presence of baboons, and not only for the people, but for the baboons themselves. So baboons were being poisoned, they were being shot, dogs were being set on them. And on the flip side of the coin is that humans would come home to a house which was absolutely trashed, and the house had been closed. South Africa's got real issues with human crime as it is, so most houses are fairly secure. But baboons were working out incredible ways, removing tiling from roofs, popping sliding doors out, removing the beading from windows to gain access to the house. It was break-ins. It was break-ins during the time, and very often the baboons learned that the best time, and there's a great parallel here with human crime, the best time to break in is when the people are there, because then things are open, fridges, cupboards, and what have you. So that's the time to get in, because then you can scare the humans, chase them into a room, get them to lock themselves up, and then you can sit down to a leisurely meal. Open the fridge, get out the sugar, you name it. And it was chronic. I mean, we had, I think the single worst case I had was a heavily pregnant woman with her two-year-old child who'd been pinned in her room for hours while a big male, a lone big male, helped himself to everything in her house. And every time she tried to come out of the room, he would race at her with his mouth open, showing off his seriously large teeth. She actually thought that her kid was at large in the house, so she kept trying to leave the room to find her kid. Meanwhile, the kid was hiding under the bed, absolutely traumatized. So they left, you know, sort of upped and off out the country. And that's the level of the conflict.
What a terrifying experience. What was their natural predator?
Lions and leopards loom large as the predators of baboons, and of course the lions went, Cape Town was replete with both before Europeans came in and decimated the wildlife. And it's actually very interesting, because currently Europeans are very cross with Africans for the losses that we are experiencing. So lion populations are declining rapidly. In my opinion, it's much more of an issue than the rhino, which gets a lot more press. The rhino is of concern because of the rate. It's very much like the climate change story. It's the sudden rapid increase in the rate of removal of rhino. But lions are in much more trouble. They've lost 80% of their habitat. And, you know, Europeans say to Africans, oi, stop that. It's your iconic beast. It's very important. But it's, you know, it's very much part and parcel of poor people uplifting themselves by extracting resources, which typically is the lion's prey, or trying to grow beef, which is their income, and of course the lions eat that. So conflict is just amazingly high in Africa right now.
So in the Cape Town situation, a reintroduction to an apex predator like a lion is not really an option. So what was the approach? What did you do?
Yeah, so the first thing was to understand, you know, what are the drivers? What do the baboons need food-wise? How much space do they need that we have still left in Cape Town? And Cape Town's interesting. Table Mountain, which is a, you know, sort of World Heritage Site and an icon for Cape Town, the only reason why it exists as a national park is because we couldn't build on it and we couldn't farm it. So this big lump of rock. So topography is the greatest conservation agent in the Western Cape and Cape Town. So now we have this lump sitting in the middle of a huge city of 3 million people. And that's where the baboon lives. And they've been pushed into this sort of marginal area. And that means in order for them to get enough food, they've got to push down towards the urban edge. And it's a very hard edge between the buildings and then where the national park starts. It literally goes from house to nature reserve. So the baboons are coming down, and the first program was to just chase them away. And the baboons very quickly realized that, okay, you can push us out, but we're not that scared of you. And they overcame their initial fear of humans chasing them and would skirt around them. Humans are no match for the 4x4 baboon, who can go absolutely anywhere. So they would get into houses, into farming areas. The great vineyards of Cape Town are rich pickings for baboons. There's nothing that they can't get into. In fact, I think the worst type of conflict that we've experienced was when one baboon in particular, I think he made it onto Sydney's the Sydney Herald front page. His name was Fred, and he learned to get into cars. So we have another great crime issue in South Africa called hijacking. And here we had Fred the baboon, who would watch people walking back towards their parked vehicles. And as they pressed the unlock on the remote, the sort of tweet-tweet noise, he would run up to the car, knowing that the door was now unlocked, open the car door, and he'd be in. And you wouldn't get him out until he had been through the glove compartment and all other, open the bags. And that's Fred. Fred was doing the most extraordinary raiding in cars, and he became a specialist. He would wait on the roads and hijack cars. So for a long time, and this is a really interesting story about the urban perspective on wildlife conflict, a lot of people were opposed to any sort of forceful displacement of the baboons. So there were these men trying to chase them away, but they didn't have tools. And every time they tried to use something, so at one stage they were given bullwhips to make a cracking noise, and people objected. The newspapers had a field day, barbarian management and what have you. And this was just to make noise to keep the baboons at bay. And eventually this reached a sort of stalemate where baboons were coming in, being poisoned, being shot. Something had to give. So we brought in international experts and said, look, can you deliberate on what you're seeing here? What do you think should happen? And they said, get rid of them. Just cull them. Get rid of them. This is spilt milk. These baboons have learned bad habits. You'll never turn it back. And, of course, the population of Cape Town, urban population, doesn't want that. They want to keep the baboons. So we're sort of stuck. We need a sustainable solution. So the latest development has been paintball guns. And paintball guns work very well in baboons because they know that you can affect an action at a distance from yourself.
Just like the recreational one, that team-building paintball guns.
Exactly. But there's all sorts of negative connotations to that. You know, you've got people walking around a national park with guns shooting wildlife. And, you know, we have enough issues with guns in South Africa as it is. You don't want to be walking in the mountain and, you know, one of the seven wonders of the world, and there's these people with guns. So something else had to happen. And that's when we arrived at the solution. And that's one of the things I've been talking about here in Sydney is, It's not rocket science, it's a fence. And everyone said it would be impossible to deter baboons with a fence. And so we designed some with, we had one suburb which agreed to finance it, and a 2.4 meter high electrified fence is 100% successful at thwarting baboons. And it's a win-win situation. It's going to save money on management. Raiding dropped to zero in that community. They now like the baboons because they can leave there and go for a walk in the mountains, and they're not in their houses anymore. So we have a solution, and it really was quite simple. So now the issue is convincing the politicians that this is the answer.
And no doubt it comes at considerable cost as well.
It's so interestingly, it's $1.8 million Australian dollars to fence off all the suburbs of Cape Town, which is really interesting because the current budget is $1 million per annum to run 60 people with paintball guns. So it's much more effective, and in 2 years it will be, you know, much cheaper than the existing management. So it's cost effective and more effective at achieving its goal.
My guest on Bush Telegraph is Professor Justin O'Rean, who's a behavioural ecologist from Cape Town University, who's in Australia at the moment. Justin, this is all very interesting, but why is it relevant, the baboon example, why is it relevant to Australia, where, at least on land, the conflict between humans and animals tends to be in rural areas, and if you're talking apex predators, it's farmers and dogs, or it's a conflict with, say, foxes or feral cats in other areas?
Yes, it's true. You have very different problems. And, of course, you've built the world's biggest fence ever. So fencing, so part of my discussion in Sydney is that the long-term solution for lions, it turns out, if we're going to stop lions from eating people, because they're eating a lot of people, and I'll give you a statistic there. In Tanzania, over a 15-year period, 800 people were attacked by lions. This is recently. this is now. And we just don't hear about it. I mean, it's a staggering level of predation. And Craig Packer, who's the undisputed leader in lion research, has come up with a solution. And it's dovetailing with what we've come up in Cape Town. It's fencing. So he's shown very successfully that if you fence a nature reserve, then people stop going in, lions stop going out, the humans don't get eaten, the livestock of the humans don't get eaten, and the lion population reaches carrying capacity of that land. So the best solution for conserving lions in Africa is fencing. The best solution for conserving baboons in Cape Town and in all the farming areas in the Western Cape, sort of the region around, is fencing. And then lastly, when it comes to white sharks, and this is where the story sort of, you know, I realized that there was great parallels. One of the most important things to do is to give recreational users in the ocean the option of a 100% safe swim. And that comes down to an underwater fence. So fencing for lions, fencing for white sharks, fencing for baboons, fencing, period, is to buy us time while we sort ourselves up and come up with, hopefully, much better technological solutions. It doesn't really pertain to the challenges that you have with dingoes. When it comes to the dingo debate, we've got jackals in South Africa, jackals and caracals. We've got two meso predators. So your dingo is what we would have as a meso predator, because sitting above the dingo in South Africa, sitting above the jackal, is, of course, the lion and the leopard. So there is the notion that if you could bring in the lion and the leopard, you would suppress the equivalent of the dingo, the jackal, and with that, the damage to small livestock. It's very interesting for me to see that the differential response in Australia, the crocodile that recently ate someone up in the north, was killed. Mm. I mean, there was no denying that what the human did was foolish. There was a snagged line and he walked into the river. And I'd been on that river all of a week before. And there are signs everywhere. I mean, everywhere you go in Australia, there are signs. I think Australia is the best signed country I've ever been to. And of course, you've got so many lethal things that there are signs everywhere. Stingers and crocodiles and white sharks. And there was no excuse, really, for what he did. So why kill the crocodile? It made absolutely no sense whatsoever. It's perplexing. And then we were fortunate that we were traveling around, so we got to meet lots of Australians. We got to meet the grey nomads, which are a wonderful cross-section of society, and poll them. What do you think? And countless conversations. No one was in support of removing the crocodile. Everyone realized that the human had made a very simple error. I mean, we're talking about some lion here.
Do you make the same argument though with the great white shark example, where we saw the culling off the West Australian coast recently? Do you equally argue that a surfer that goes off the coast near Margaret River is putting themselves at risk and should know better?
Yes, very much so. So the second fatality in Australia during my visit was at Byron Bay, and it was a white shark who appears to have tasted, and I use that word specifically, an open water ocean swimmer, someone who had gone to live in Byron Bay because they particularly like doing open water swimming. And what I've been amazed at in traveling around Australia is the number of people that go for seriously long swims in the ocean, far out to sea. And that, in my opinion, is putting yourself at risk. I do a lot of work on seals and sharks, and it's the lone seal that gets taken by the sharks. And if you're in a group, you have a much better chance of not being eaten. Not only by dilution, but sharks tend to avoid groups because groups have got lots of eyes and they're not as easy to predate upon. So you are, without a shadow of doubt, putting yourself at risk. What was amazing is talking to the people at Byron Bay, you know, 24 hours after the incident, and there was no call for retribution. There was a complete acceptance that the human had made a choice and that the shark had done nothing other than explore a food item. Now, when you have a mouthful of teeth, an exploration, a tentative bite, can end the life of a human. And that's really what happened. I mean, there was a very small wound and it just happened to be in an artery. And so the person appears to have bled out. And it was wonderful to see the mayor saying that there was absolutely no cause for concern, no need to install drum lines or nets, and a very calm, accepting attitude that is one of the genuine risks of going into the ocean. Mm. Of course, more people die of drowning on Australian beaches than will ever from sharks.
So do you argue then that in wherever a conflict exists between wildlife and humans, no matter how that conflict is expressed, the answer comes down to adjusting human behaviour and fencing rather than culls, baits, poisoning, trapping, whatever it might be?
No, I can't be as hard and fast as that. I've been very intrigued with the baiting story. The poisoning, I've tried to get as much of the research down. It seems that many of the biologists think that dingoes are very important for biodiversity. So where dingoes are, they're suppressing your foxes and your cats. There is a study which suggests that there's not a huge impact of throwing 1080 all over the landscape. Coming from South Africa, that's an activity which is illegal. You can't use poison in the landscape. It's too indiscriminate. And so there are all these great difficulties. It's such a complicated subject, and there's certainly never a silver bullet. I think the great difficulty that we all have is that we've broken so many ecosystems that we have to manage them. So I would say that in Cape Town, if we do these fences but we don't have apex predators, it's inevitable that we're going to have to manage the numbers, which is culling. Getting over how the hurdle is, the people who live in Cape Town won't accept that. But what's the alternative? It's like your Brumbies. I've just learned this morning, talking to some people at Sydney, that there are Brumbies in Australia which are starving to death and who are cannibalizing the guts of dead horses because they're starving to death. Now, what would be better would be to manage those numbers, because there's nothing eating those horses. So when they've flattened their food resource, then, you know, they're going to starve to death. And what's better, a clean shot or starving to death and scavenging on a dead conspecific? I would go for the shooting side of it.
It's perhaps easier from someone overseas, though. I guess it's easier to make that judgment without the fog or the interference of the cultural relevance that many people place on the animal as well.
Absolutely. Though. And this is really where, you know, after I gave a talk, an open public talk last night, and I think the most interesting question that I got after that was this issue of change, of behavioral change in humans and cultural significance of things. So the Western Australian debate with the shark was fascinating for us in South Africa, because it was paradoxical by virtue of the fact that the whole East Coast has been culling sharks with nets and with drum lines since 1937. I think the first nets went in Sydney. So Sydney, New South Wales, pioneered the concept of shark nets explicitly for the purpose that if you kill enough sharks, the probability of an attack drops. Now, that is pretty archaic. We can excuse that in the early 1930s. Interestingly, during the Second World War, the nets came out and no one was eaten. Everyone was still in the water. So there seems when you put these nets in, there's a massive drop-off. And what they did with the drum lines in Western Australia, they put it in. There was massive public opposition. We were so impressed with the Australian public. And the authorities rode a roughshod over it. All the experts disagreed with the government decision. All the experts around the world disagreed with the government decision, and they still went ahead. That's perplexing. I still would like to know what the real reason is. I suspect it's tourism. I suspect it's the dollar of people coming to spend time at the beach. Something as simple as economics. Mm. And these issues are always beyond the biologists, which is why we've got to work with the sociologists and the economists. And I think the sociologists have got a huge role to play.
So if killing an animal, a species, a predator, does not reduce the likelihood of an attack, and you use the shark instance then, Do we apply the same principle, the same theory to the farming example I gave you earlier, where if you kill dogs, you think you protect your livestock, but maybe that's just not the case?
Yeah, so I think, look, your dog here is your apex predator. So when there's sheep involved, there's no denying that they will do a lot of damage to the small livestock without any shadow of doubt, which makes the dingo fence really interesting. I gather that biodiversity on the sheep side of the dingo fence, where the dingoes have been excluded, is appalling. So there's been massive impacts of sheep and absence of dingoes on Australian biodiversity. On the other side, I had naively hoped that where there are cattle, they would be too big for dingoes. And biologists tell me that that's largely the case. The dingoes will occasionally take a calf or a sickly adult. So in South Africa, a jackal, your equivalent. If there is cattle, we regard that as problem solved. It's the small livestock where there is an issue. So it's very perplexing for us to see that 1080 is being used throughout Queensland, which is almost exclusively cattle. And they really do need that, and it seems to be cultural that you always hit the dingo. There's dingo were vermin. In fact, go back in the history books, marsupials. There was a bounty on marsupials. You were obligated to kill marsupials when you moved into the interior of Queensland. You were demanded that you had to get rid of anything, and it was foreign. It was something different. It was something not to be accepted. And there seems to be a hangover that I spoke to many farmers. On our travels, and you know, the farmer and the farmer's son go hunting dingoes. They put foot traps out. The government helps them with the 1080 poisoning. It's warfare, and it's not convincing that it's actually doing anything other than wasting money.
It's a lot to think about. It's definitely a debate. It seems that it's going somewhere. It's changing, no doubt. Professor Justin O'Rean, thank you so much for coming in and joining us on Bush Telegraph today. Been great chatting with you.
It's a pleasure.
Professor O'Rean is a behavioural ecologist at the University of Cape Town in South Africa, been in Australia giving some talks of late, some strong views there. I wonder what you think of them. The story is up on our website now. Just go to the RN homepage and find us on the program guide. You can comment there if you like, or if you prefer, you can find us on Facebook and share your views on Professor O'Rean's views of conservation. You are listening to Bush Telegraph. I'm Cameron Wilson, RN and Radio Australia, and today's program is all about conservation, what's changing, how our attitudes are changing, and what practices are changing to try to stop the loss of native animals here in Australia. We've established so far that Australia has about the worst mammal extinction rate in the world. Among the species that no longer exist are obviously the Tasmanian tiger, there's several wallabies, potoroos, bandicoots as well. Many of Australia's surviving and extinct species were documented 150 years ago by the famous British ornithologist and zoologist John Gould in a landmark series of books. Fred Ford is a modern-day zoologist, and he's put aside his interest in checking out owl vomit and crawling into tight caves to revisit Gould's remarkable work through his own book. This book's called John Gould's Extinct and Endangered Mammals of Australia. Fred, welcome to the program.
You want to count?
Let's start with some about John Gould first. People will be, I imagine most people are familiar with his work around birds. How extensive is his work on Australian mammals?
Yeah, certainly birds is what John Gould's most known for. He produced a number of really quite lavish works on birds of Asia and Europe, and really built a reputation both as a preparator of birds in terms of making stuffed specimens for both museum collections and also just for people's collections, because in the Victorian period people were extremely fond of having shiny things, and biological specimens were often seen as a real trophy, in inverted commas, I guess, for decorating the house and showing some prestige. And really the mammal side of Gould's work was a bit of a sideline when he came to Australia. He was coming to Australia for the dedicated purpose of making a comprehensive work of Australia's birds to follow on from the work he'd already done. And that's really what funded his trip to Australia. So he advertised before he came out that he was going to do this work and took subscriptions from people that wanted to get these very large, very colourful folios describing and illustrating the birds that he was going to make. But before he came out, he's a very active member of the London zoological community and the Royal Society. So he, again, part of his reputation was working on the birds that Charles Darwin had collected on the voyage of the Beagle. So he really was seen in the upper echelons of the Zoological Society in London, and so the people that he was talking to there firmly were pushing him towards also collecting and at least bringing back to London so that other people could look at the mammals. But clearly once he got here, he began to understand that there was a very diverse and interesting fauna of things that he clearly grew quite fond of while he was here.
Became more than a sideline interest, didn't it? There was the three volumes, ultimately, of the mammals of Australia. Where exactly did he document them?
In terms of the places in Australia, he actually started off in Tasmania, and him and his collector that he brought out with him, John Gilbert, in 1838, started collecting through Tasmania, or Van Diemen's Land then. And he pretty quickly realised that there was such a task that he was going to have to split efforts and sent Gilbert off to Western Australia, which was really a very small colony of Swan River at that point. And Gould himself started working in South Australia and New South Wales, basically just to try and get as broad a scope as he could. And then after Gould left, Gilbert also went back to England, but came back out again and started working through Queensland and joined Leichhardt's expedition as well. So he really got quite a large sampling right the way across Australia, and including Port Essington and right in the top end, which was one of the very first outposts in that part of the continent.
So there's a lot to really enjoy about this book, and the images are a part of, no small part of that. But what's really grabbed me is what it tells us about our attitudes, or Australian attitudes, early attitudes to Australian native animals. What does Gould's work, what sort of insight does Gould's work give you to those attitudes?
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing, and it's something that I was aware of before the book, but through researching the book and looking much more at, rather than formal works, but at first-hand accounts from letters in newspapers and stories that people had written, it really emphasised to me the change from, in the early days, you can imagine that people are coming from England to a very foreign country, but there's a real curiosity in all echelons of society, from convicts right through to governors, about what sort of animals there are out there, because there's always the chance of finding the next platypus or some bizarre curio, but also which ones were good to eat, which ones had a potential for farming, which ones would be potentially domesticatable.
It seems to me that's how an animal was, its value was perceived. Could it be eaten? Could it be traded?
Absolutely. The first and foremost value on things, particularly you've got to remember, there's a very small numbers of people with very, very long supply chains back to England. So anything that was of potential value to those people that was already in Australia that could obviously cope with the conditions, that could be a source of fur instead of wool or any resource, was of great value. And particularly for the poorer people, as settlements started to spread out into the broader countryside with no money and the capacity just to live off the land, obviously the first thing you might be able to turn to before you've managed to clear trees and set wheat and do the other things that people were more familiar with was to actually find out what the country could provide to you of itself.
You're hearing here from Fred Ford, zoologist, and the man behind the book, John Gould's Extinct and Endangered Mammals of Australia. We've also got Joe Carmel with you. Joe's the book editor. Joe, thanks for holding on there. What have you learnt about our early attitudes to native animals in the process of putting this book together?
I've learnt a lot about it. And as Fred said, it wasn't so much what Gould said himself, but it's the little newspaper reports, you know, the attitudes towards the so-called pests, the pests being the thylacine, Tasmanian devils, quolls.
Pest was not introduced animal back then, was it?
No, no, it wasn't. It wasn't. It was, you know, the thylacine and the devils were sort of bloodthirsty animals which killed the farmers' sheep, and the quolls were always in the hen house destroying hens, and the bandicoots were digging up people's lawns, and this was appalling. I mean, some of the attitudes, I've got a quote here, calling the thylacine a wretched marauder, first among the countless vermin of the region. And a description in the London Daily Mail described it as one of the most stupid animals. Its lack of intelligence is the cause of its untameableness.
It seems that this Gould was obviously aware of this was how these animals were perceived locally. And is it fair to say that's what led to some of his predictions of extinction?
Yes, that's right. That, you know, the thylacine, there were bounties on various animals, the thylacine being one of them, and he did predict that the thylacine would disappear. and it did. He also predicted that the koala would disappear, but it wasn't until fairly recently that that was put on the National Endangered List. I don't know, what date was that, Fred?
In 2012.
2012. Mm.
Because I guess there's, I learned about people going out to shoot numerous animals, including koalas, and the extent to which their pelts had been traded through this book. I wasn't aware of
that. Oh, yes. Yeah, thousands and thousands and thousands of koala pelts were traded. And it wasn't just the trading, it wasn't just the fur that they and other animals were used as sport, that people would just go out and take pot shots at these animals just for the hell of it. And in the book there's this wonderful picture of a gunman who's bracing himself against a tree, aiming high up into the tree to shoot a poor defenceless koala. But apparently the koalas learnt that when gunmen were around, that they had to climb up higher and higher as the guns got more powerful and could shoot further. So they weren't stupid about it.
Mm-hmm. Fred, you start the book. We've mentioned the thylacine. It's the first animal you look at in your book, the Tasmanian tiger. Why did you begin there?
I think it's a natural place, really, to start with any discussion of Australian extinction, because it's worldwide, it's right up there as one of the iconic stories of extinction, next to the dodo, really. And it's a really interesting one in terms of people's attitude, because one of the melancholy elements of Gould's description of the inevitable demise of the thylacine was everyone could see it happening, and that goes for everyone around the world. Foreign accounts at the same time, right through the late 1800s and early 1900s, all alluded to the fact that the thylacine was going to go extinct and that it was a tragedy. But on top of that, recognising, much like your last speaker was talking about, that it was a genuine threat to the industries and agriculture and pastoralism in Tasmania. So there was an understanding at that stage that the duality of the paradox of the situation, that there was an animal that was so unique and so different to anything else in the world, and it was a tragedy that it would be lost, but also that it was going to be lost unless it was, I think the Tasmanian Parliament in debate went, all right, well, if we're going to have them, we've got to get them as far away from everyone as possible, and brought in the notion of a tiger reserve on the west coast. But ironically, that didn't get instated until long after the last Tasmanian tiger had died. But
yeah. So, Fred, is there, in the course of researching this and putting this book together, do you feel there's anything from the historical examples here that we could learn and apply to conservation today?
Yeah, certainly. I think some of the key messages really are around something that Joe touched on, that a lot of these animals have an innate ability to be pests. If you give them the right set of circumstances, things like bettongs and bandicoots can do fantastically well. If you take foxes out of the equation, and we see this in many very active recovery efforts around the country now, if you put up fences and you control foxes, cats, rabbits, you can have problems, again, somewhat paradoxically, too many bettongs, too many bilbies. They dig holes, they're a nuisance, which is great. It's a great problem to have. And if you look at the early days of settlement, before rabbits and foxes really swept across the landscape, they're the problems people had. Even in the local area here in Canberra, there's many accounts of people getting sick of bettongs eating their potato crops, and in South Australia, stories of bettongs wandering into people's houses and stealing food. So it would be fantastic if we got a glimpse of that again.
We've always had this tension, haven't we? The interface between humans and animals. Look, Fred, it's a beautiful book. Congratulations on it. Thank you for telling us all about it today. Fred Ford, zoologist, and his book is John Gould's Extinct and Endangered Mammals of Australia. And Joe Carmel is the book editor. Joe, thanks for coming in today. I appreciate it. It's a book that's published on the 1st of October by National Library of Australia Publishing. That's the program for today. As I said earlier, any views on today's conservation coverage, you can find the story up now on our website, or you'll find us at Facebook or at RN Bushtelly on Twitter. You're on RN.
In the body sphere, when it comes to running, what are sensible shoes? Minimalist? Maximalist? Barefoot?
I remember the first time I did that, it just felt wonderful. I felt like a kid taking off my shoes on a beach.
If you're barefoot, you're getting maximum sensory feedback from your feet.
Of course, my feet really hurt for probably a week after that.
So where's the great running shoe debate up to?
We still don't really understand the interaction between footwear and the foot.
The Body Sphere, this afternoon at 1 on RN.